Welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks with expert advice from Jim Lang, Pittsburgh-based CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert. Jim is also the best-selling author of the first and second edition of Retire Secure and his newest book, The Roth Revolution. To find out more about these books, his practice, Lang Financial Group, or how to secure Jim as a speaker for your next event, visit the website, retiresecure.com. Now, get ready to talk smart money.
Hi, this is Jim Lang. Today we'll be learning some powerful tax strategies with Sandy Botkin, the president of the Tax Reduction Institute of Germantown, Maryland. Sandy's both an attorney and a CPA. He's a former trainer of IRS attorneys nationwide, and now he's on our side. Sandy is a best-selling author and nationally syndicated writer. His recent books are Lower Your Taxes Big Time and Real Estate Taxes of the Rich, both published by McGraw-Hill and available from your local bookstore or online bookseller. I was really impressed with Lower Your Taxes Big Time. Some of the things almost seem too good to be true, but Sandy is very credible. Again, CPA attorney, worked for the IRS and actually trained IRS agents, and his book is very well documented, so it has source codes and revenue rulings and citations to Internal Revenue Codes and cases, so he's really talking on sound ground. And there's a lot of good ideas. In fact, some of them I didn't know, and I went to some of the CPAs in my office, and I said, hey, did you know this? And a bunch of them said, yeah, I knew that, but some of them they didn't. So I think it is a really good book that has a lot of information for all taxpayers, but especially, I'm going to say, for taxpayers that have a small business, maybe a one-person, a two-person, or a family business. For those of you who have those small businesses, I think that's kind of a no-brainer to buy his book. And it's my pleasure to introduce Sandy Botkin. Welcome to the show, Sandy.
Oh, it's my honor. It's a real pleasure.
Well, you start out the book by saying that everybody should have a side business. You know, whether you have a full-time job and you're doing something on the side, or I even got the idea that you wanted some retirees to have a small side business. And I have some other reasons why I like a small side business other than the ones that you started with. But I thought I would ask you why you think people should consider having a part-time self-employed income or a small business.
Well, you know, there's really a lot of reasons for this. First of all, everybody needs to understand, Jim, that we have two tax systems in this country. And when I say that, people think, oh, sure, one for rich and one for poor. And that is not quite right. There's one to make you poor, and then there's one to make you rich.
I like that.
I do, too.
Okay? The one to make you poor are those that your employees that have no business. They're the ones, they are taxed on dollar one. They get very little deductions. They could basically deduct their charity, the interest on their home, and probably some of that's going to be eliminated at some point in the future. But if you are in business, you can write off part of your house, your spouse, the equivalent of your kids' education and weddings. I'm not kidding when I say that. You can set up a pension plan that makes any government plan paltry by comparison. It's just enormous. And let people say, well, what happens if my business generates a loss? Well, then you get the government subsidizing you. Because if your business generates a loss, you can use that loss against any form of income you have. Interest, dividends, wages, rent, pensions, anything. So let's take an example. Let's say one of your listeners makes $50,000 a year from their job or from their retirement, and they have a part-time business that generates a $10,000 loss. They only pay taxes on the net, the $40,000. Let's assume the loss, let's say you're a single parent and your loss exceeds your whole income for the year. You can carry back all business losses 2 years and get a refund from the federal and state government for the last 2 years of taxes that you pay. You actually get a check, or you can carry forward all properly documented business deductions 20 years and offset the next 20 years of earnings. And this doesn't discount the fact that maybe that small business will make you a lot of money, in which case you can stop working for that job and work out of your home and create all kinds of fringe benefits for yourself. I mean, it blows me away. It really does, how people will work harder and harder for a job with less and less potential to get ahead, to me, I would recommend you put in as little as possible to avoid being fired and get that side business started as fast as possible.
And by the way, that goes for everybody except for my employees.
Right. hopefully they won't be listening to this, right?
Unfortunately, one's
I'm
right
sitting
here.
Right here. One's right here.
and I think a few of the other ones are because they are very interested. The other thing, it's kind of interesting. I was actually talking with one of the CPAs today, and she said that she had an unusually large number of people who lost their jobs during the year, and they're trying to regroup and figure out what to do. So some of this advice is very good for them. I also have some tax reasons. Now, you know, by the way, your book does a great job about talking about what kinds of things you can deduct, and even just in your start, you were talking about some of the things that people in small business can usually deduct, assuming it is a legitimate business expense that people who are employed cannot. But one of the things that I like, and you mentioned it briefly, is that the retirement plans available to small business owners are just so much more favorable than those available to employees, both in terms of how much money you could put away, both in terms of as a percentage of your salary, and you can put in up to either $16,000 or $22,000 in a one-person 401k.
Actually, you could do more than that.
And actually,
you
a lot more than that.
A lot more than that.
Right. That's if your income is relatively low.
Correct.
And the other thing that I like to do is I sometimes am using those creating retirement plans for self-employed people or even people who have traditional jobs or maybe they're retired from traditional jobs. If they have some self-employment income, then they can start a one-person 401k plan. And a lot of our clients have after-tax dollars or non-deductible IRAs. And we have an interesting method. We've gone through it a couple of times on the radio in prior shows, and I'm not going to do that again now. But through jumping through a couple hoops, we can actually isolate some of those after-tax dollars, do a Roth IRA conversion for free.
Mm-hmm.
And the other advantage of having a self-employed retirement plan, like a one-person 401k plan, is that you could actually do a Roth IRA conversion on that plan even after you die, which is nice, and it has better creditor protection.
Gee, I didn't know I'd be able to come back from the dead and do it after I die. That's a good trick.
Well,
maybe you can show me how to do that one.
All right, well, let's assume for discussion's sake that you have...
Now, state might be able to do it, but I'm not so sure I'd be doing it.
Well, that's true. On the other hand, if you have even just say, let's say you have... whatever it is, let's use a nice round number like $1 million in your IRA, and let's say that you die and you leave it to, and let's leave the spouses out of it for the moment, and you leave it to your kids, and your kids basically have an inherited IRA, and they are not allowed to make a Roth IRA conversion from it. But if you leave them $1 million in a one-person 401k plan, which while you're alive is essentially the same thing, in fact, it's even better while you're alive, then they can make a Roth IRA conversion. You get better creditor protection because it is an ERISA plan, and so there are multiple advantages of having that one-person 401k plan.
While you're mentioning this, let me get into this because that seems to be like the in thing where everybody's saying, well, convert your 401ks to Roths, and to a large extent, I'm a fan. I tend to agree with that. When I say converting, just to make sure everybody understands this, this is where you take the money in your 401k or your simple IRA or your SEP, and you actually transfer it directly, you have to do it right, to a Roth IRA, and you're taxed on the money. You actually pay the tax as if it was a normal distribution. The advantage of that is that it is all tax-free for the rest of your life. But the problem is there's a lot of side effects. Now, it's not like the drug companies where they talk about side effects. I love when you watch these drug commercials. They're beautiful commercials. You see the ocean, and then they say side effects, loss of blindness, loss of hearing. Death, that's my favorite side effect. The side effects are not quite that bad, but there are side effects. They really need a professional to go over this to see if it's valid. For example, a lot of deductions and credits phase out, like the American Opportunity deduction for credits for college phase out based on income. If you are applying for financial aid for your kids, the last thing you should ever do is do a Roth conversion in the year that the financial aid applications is looked at.
That's
so, there are all these side effects.
And I'll tell you the big side effects that we've, by the way, I would agree with you completely on this. And we crunch numbers all the time. The most common one for most of the listeners that I imagine are listening tonight is that the taxation of their Social Security often goes up, and it also has an impact on the Medicare Part B
absolutely.
Premiums.
Absolutely. That you pay a higher tax on your Social Security, and that's right. You're right.
So I would agree with you completely on that. On the other hand, sometimes what happens is it's a great idea anyway, and our office does a lot of number crunching on this, and we've actually had multiple shows on this issue. But
let me give one tip, since it may have not been said. I was looking at doing a Roth conversion myself, and I was saying to myself, you know, I'm not that far from retirement. What am I going to do when I retire? And the answer is move to Florida. And I'm thinking, well, if I'm going to move to Florida relatively soon, why don't I do the Roth conversion when I'm in Florida and not pay any state income tax, which I would have to pay here in Maryland?
Well, that's a good point. Now, in Pennsylvania, there actually is no – Pennsylvania is not a good state to work in, because they don't give you a break on your IRA or retirement plan contribution. So that's why most of us, if we're preparing our tax returns right now and we are employed, or even if we're self-employed and we're making a contribution to a retirement plan, we get to deduct the amount for our federal tax return, but for Pennsylvania tax purposes, we have to pay the entire amount. We don't get a deduction.
Ooh, that is horrible.
That is horrible. But when we retire in Pennsylvania, we don't have to pay income taxes on IRA distributions, we don't have to pay taxes on pensions, and we don't have to pay taxes on Roth IRA conversions.
Well, you know why they do that, don't you?
Well, they get you up front.
No, because everybody's moving to Florida, so they're not going to have to worry about it anyway.
Well, actually, in your case, you know, probably, you know, if let's say that for discussion's sake that you are at the peak of your earning career, you know, you're writing books and you're doing lectures and you doing consulting, et cetera, et cetera. And then let's say, I don't know if you're going to actually truly retire, but let's say that you truly do retire, you'll be in a lower tax bracket, and you're going to be, let's say, in Florida, it might make a lot more sense to wait until after you retire to do the conversion.
I think that's true, although my goal is to be in a higher tax bracket, so my kids can live to the style that I want to be accustomed to. That's the second point.
I like that. All right. So there really are a lot of advantages of being self-employed, and particularly for taxes. And one of the things, I like a lot of things about your book, but one of the things that I liked is that, you know, you sometimes see, I want to almost say sensationalists saying all these things that you can do. I was one time on a TV show with, I think his name was Irving Schiff, and he's one of these tax evader guys, and he said, at first he said, don't file a return, and then he got thrown in jail. And so he didn't like that idea.
I was going to suggest that if you listen to Irving Schiff, you can also wear orange. It may not look good on you.
Yeah, and then he said, okay, no, that's wrong. File a tax return, but write zero for your income.
He is such a nut.
Yeah,
in tax court, you know, when he finally went to jail and he had to testify against somebody, he looked at the guy and he said, well, what do you get listening to me? I mean, he's such a nut.
Well, he is a nut, but I guess my point is that some of the things he were saying were kind of sensational, but it couldn't be backed up. Some of the things that you're saying, even though they're not sensational, they're like, wow, you know, it sounds great. You know, deduct the cost of your kid's education, deduct the cost of your wife doing all these things. And then when you read it, I say
deduct the equivalent.
Fair enough.
and you say deduct the education.
And then when I read it, I say, oh, I see what he's doing. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, even things like employing your children, you know, I think is a good idea. You know, I always caution people, but then they should really do a little bit of work. Not just a sham.
You're absolutely right.
Transaction.
And I say that in the book. I say that in Lower Your Taxes big time. But I want to emphasize a couple things here. You know, we Americans have been, and it's funny, I actually did a blog on this. I have a special blog that I do every single day on tax and financial tips. It's on my facebook.com/loweryourtaxes. And one of the things I say is that we Americans have been really bad when it comes to tax, to any kind of planning. We will spend tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, if we get into trouble. But to spend 1% of that on planning, which would avoid the trouble, people are not willing to do. And that's the very sad fact of what goes on in life. And I think if anything that they get from this conversation that we're having, you know, don't be cheap. Go to do tax planning every year, especially if you're in business. Don't be cheap. You know, get my book, Lower Your Taxes Big Time. Discuss it with your accountant. do estate planning, certainly every couple years. And if you have any family changes or you change your residence, do it again. You know, business planning. Go to a good business lawyer when you set up a business. Don't just try to do it yourself. Don't do your own will. Always do estate planning. Forget about LegalZoom. That's garbage. You want to get a contract? Have it read by a professional. Don't just, you know, do it yourself. People try to save money. They become penny wise and dollar foolish, and it's the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
Well, I'll tell you something pretty dumb would be to try to do some tax planning, not get your book, because honestly, if you go through your book, I mean, and it even gave me a couple ideas. You know, for example, I think we have to take a break.
We do have to take a break. We will be right back on the Lang Money Hour. And actually, please remember, we are live tonight. So if you want to talk to Jim and Sandy, please give us a call, 412-333-9385. That's 412-333-9385. And we will be right back.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. Again, before the break, I said the show is live. Give us a buzz, 412-333-9385. And just want to give a quick reminder out there. If you want to listen to Jim and meet him in person, definitely stop by. We have a new workshop coming up March 26th at the Monroeville Doubletree. You can call 1-800-748-1571 to register, or you can always call our office directly. And one thing before you get back into it, I promised one of our listeners, Sandy, this is a question for you. And we sent out the e-blast promoting the show, and right back one of our loyal listeners, Jim from Michigan, wanted to ask you a question about lower your taxes big time.
Okay.
He said he will be listening to the show tonight, but he was wondering if you will be coming out with another book, another update to that book to include the 2010 tax bill. And if you will, when will it be out?
I think it's out.
It's out right now.
It's out now?
Every single year.
Okay.
I included the new Hires Act. I included four new chapters. I included a chapter on scams, slams, and shams, which are the latest scams that are hitting North America, including how to avoid being Madoffed.
Okay, so it's out.
It's out right now.
Where do you want people to go? Where can they get this book?
They can go to either Amazon.com, okay. They go to Barnes & Noble, they can go to any bookstore and order it. It's called Lower Your Taxes Big Time.
Big Time, okay.
Yeah, but
that's the best way to do it. And I would strongly recommend they also go to my daily blog, which is facebook.com/loweryourtaxes, to get a new tax or financial tip every day.
Okay.
Yeah, and for whatever it's worth, I was running a little short on time to get the hard copy, so I downloaded it and I went through it. And I really enjoyed it. You say that that you have five top tax tips for 2011. Could you start us off, and we'll get into a couple of those tips?
Well, I cover mostly the tax mistakes that people make. First of all, let me mention a couple things here. And there was a big article that was written up. It was in Reuters all over the country. First thing that I think people need to understand that the most important thing in small business, people ask me, what do you need to do to bulletproof your records from the government, to really never have to worry about an IRS audit again? I mean, if that's not worth something, I don't know what is. The answer is you've got to have a good tax organizer. Now, a tax organizer looks like an expense log, but it isn't. It really has all the tax questions right in front of you, 365 days a year, for entertainment, for travel, for automobile. All of those things. So it'll avoid procrastination, which is a big killer of deductions, force you to do what you need to do, and when an IRS sees these tax organizers properly filled out, that's the end of the problem, and all your deductions will survive.
Well, I'll tell you one of the things that I liked, that I really liked in your chapter about how to turn your car into a deductible gold mine, is you actually mentioned a smartphone app.
That's correct. We are currently working on a smartphone app.
Oh,
it's about 5 months away. I thought it would be ready already, but it's not.
Oh, I thought it was ready. I was so excited about it.
Not ready yet.
It
was almost ready, and then we had a problem, and now we have to fix it. But the bottom line is we're coming out with a smartphone application that will have It'll be with most smartphones, with the exception of the BlackBerry to start, but it will be with the iPhone and the Droid, where you have all your tax questions right in front of you, 365 days a year. It'll upload it to a website stored for you. It'll store your receipt and attach it to it. You can take a picture of the receipt and then store it. And then we'll have an automatic mileage tracker between business and personal. It'll keep track every 5 minutes of where you went, what the mileage is, and finally where the address is. We'll actually do it automatically.
Okay.
That's so amazing. That's
all right. But it's not there yet.
Not there yet. There are some things we have to do. We have to get licenses. I mean, it's delayed about 4 or 5 months, but it will be available probably around July.
All right. Well, that sounds good. Now, are most of the other tax tips just for businesses, or are they also for individuals without businesses?
Well, I'm a small business tax specialist. My specialty is for small businesses and for small real estate transactions. That's my primary specialty. I mean, there are some things that the average individual can do. But again, remember, there's a lot less if you're an employee than if you're self-employed. That's just the way it is. Certainly for the average person, there are a couple things they need to be aware of for the last-minute tax tips for 2011. One of the biggest things that people need to be aware of is the fact that you can still contribute to that IRA as long as the pension plan is in existence. You can still make the contribution before you file your tax return and yet get a deduction for last year.
That's correct. And you can do a Roth IRA for $5,000 if you are 49 or younger, or for $6,000 if you are 50 and older, and then also the same amounts for your spouse, even if your spouse isn't working.
That is correct. And even better than that, if you're in business, you can put a Roth 401k in, and instead of $5,000 or $6,000, you can put away $16,500.
I am a big fan of that. And with the one-person Roth 401k, just like a regular plan, you have both an employee and an employer share. So you can put away a lot of money. The other thing, by the way, that I'm encouraging people to do is, if you have the money, to make your 2011 Roth IRA contribution now, and that way you get an extra year of tax-free growth.
It's a very interesting point. A lot of people don't realize this, but the earlier you early birds catch the worm, the old saying, particularly true with pension plans. If you put away, here's an interesting story, if you put away $6,000, $5,000 a year into an IRA every year for 40 years, but you do it at the end of the 40th year, it's like everybody else does, they end. But instead, you do that same $5,000 a year at the beginning of each year. Same $5,000 a year, same 40 years, but by the time you retire, by the 40 years, you will have an extra $60,000 at retirement on the average.
Well, that's pretty significant.
Extra, by simply doing it at the beginning of the year instead of the end of the year. This is a really big deal that people don't realize.
And I think that makes a lot of sense. The other thing that I will just mention on things that you can do, let's say, between now and April 15th, and this is for a lot of people who already made Roth IRA conversions last year, because, Sandy, I spent a lot of time on the radio doing multiple Roth IRA conversion shows, and then most of my workshops, in fact, all of my workshops last year involved Roth IRA conversions. So I know that there's a lot of people who made Roth IRA conversions in 2010. And what I would say to them for this year is, rather than committing yourself to keeping the Roth IRA or determining if you're going to recognize the income in 2010 or half in 2011 and half in 2012, that you might be well served by filing an extension, not an extension to pay, an extension to file, and you file that by April 15th, and that gives you an extra 6 months to see how the market does, see if your investment goes up or down, see what's going on with your tax rates and whether you're better off recognizing it in 2010 or 2011 and 2012.
Well, that's a good point. And there's one more thing I think we should point out. If you made that Roth IRA conversion in 2010, what's interesting is you have the option to treat half of that income as taxable in 2011 and half of that income is taxable in 2012. You actually get a two-year deferral. Unfortunately, if you make that same Roth conversion this year, all of it is taxed this year. You do not get that conversion, as far as I know.
Yeah, that's right. Although we actually found a little way of getting around that in 2010. What one of the issues that I wanted to do, I'm a big believer in doing Roth IRA conversions up to perhaps your existing tax bracket, the top of your tax bracket, assuming some of those things that we talked about
earlier. Do a partial conversion, yes.
Correct. I was really big on that. So let's say, for discussion's sake, that you could do 3 years of conversions of $33,000 each and still be in the same tax bracket. And but what you weren't allowed to do is to do a $100,000 conversion, recognize $33,010, $33,011, and $33,012. You could either do all 100 and 10, or 50 and 11, and 50 or 12. But what we found is, and this is new, in fact, it's even after my book came out, so it's not in my book, that you could have one spouse, let's say, do 33,000, recognize it all in 2010, have the other spouse do 66,000, and recognize it half and 11 and half and 12.
Right, because you have the election. You can elect, each spouse can elect to treat that to your deferral. That's correct.
Right. Yeah, that was a really cool.
Yeah. Cool, but thing. By the way, that's a very good point that I want you to you brought up. When you make this conversion, everybody who's listening, you really want to use other money. You do not want to use the Roth money, as tempting as that is, to pay the taxes on the conversion. You've got to use other money. And a lot of times people ask me, well, gee, you know, if I'm converting a couple hundred thousand dollars into a Roth IRA, I don't have that money. Well, the answer then is do a partial conversion. Maybe you only convert 10%, 20%. You don't need to do the whole thing.
I agree completely. You know, I think one of my favorite chapters in your book, by the way, for the small business person, I think probably all the chapters are good. And, you know, we could talk a lot about some of the chapters on entertainment, and hopefully we'll have time to do Office in the Home. But one of the things that I really liked was your chapter 4 on income shifting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I think could apply to everybody, whether they have a business or whether they don't.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to give you a good examples of this. My mother was a teacher. Now, teachers do not have businesses. My dad had a business, but she didn't. And she used to have me grade her papers and pay me to grade her papers, and she would take a deduction as an employee business expense. Although that's not as good a deduction as you would be if you were self-employed, still, she was able to get that deduction. I got that money mostly tax-free because you can earn up to $5,800. Today, you can earn up to $5,800 income tax-free, believe it or not, as an employee, because you get a standard deduction for that amount. And everybody wins, and I use that money to help pay for college education. It's even better, though, if you're self-employed. I hired my son to come with me at various seminars, and he uses that money to pay for his own education. My daughter to do my website. She designs websites. She's working in it. She's going to school for web digital design, which is sort of like web design. And she charged me an outrageous amount of money, Jim, to do my website. It just happened to cover 4 years of tuition.
You're braver than
That's
I am.
That's one expensive website.
Well, you know what? And again, in my book, it provides that you have to pay a reasonable wage. You can't go crazy. So what I did was, and how do you figure out what a reasonable wage is? Well, a reasonable wage is what you would pay an outside agency to do the same thing. So what I did is I actually got a quote from a web design company on what they would charge me to design my website from scratch, doing the things I wanted to do. And I just paid my daughter something less. It just so happens that that little bit less covered her 4 years of tuition at a state university.
Right. So
I mean, there's lots of things people can do. But the key is if you don't do the planning, if you don't know to hire your kids, if you don't know what kinds of documentation you need to do these things, then you don't get the deductions, and you become one of the poor people. You're in the poor system at that point.
Right, and then there is a bonus in that you didn't have to pay Social Security on those wages that you paid to her.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. She's actually over 18, so I would have to pay Social Security, plus I'm a corporation.
Okay.
But you're right. If I was self-employed and she was under 18, there is no Social Security on wages. You're absolutely right about that. By the way, everything's got to be done correctly. That's why it's so important to get that book, Lower Your Taxes, big time, and to meet with your professional. You want to do it right. If you do it right, there's nothing IRS can do to you. If you don't do it right, then you're asking for trouble. But, you know, it's kind of like driving on the highway. If you're going within the speed limits, even though there's a radar gun there, they're not going to pull you over. And that's the whole point. Just do it right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that is good advice. Could you talk about Taxpayer Freedom Day?
Okay. There's a day that the average person has to work to pay off their federal, state, and Social Security taxes. And if you go on the web, you're going to find it varies. It depends on your income and it's based on the state you're in. But generally, it's around April 9th. It could be as high as April 19th, but it's around April 9th. Now, to put that in perspective, every day you're working in January is for the government. Every day you're working in February, every day you're working in March, and about half of April. I mean, so the average person is working over 3 months a year, almost 4 months a year, for the federal government. Mm-hmm. In fact, you're still working for the federal government. Even worse, so if you take 109 divided by 365, roughly 30% of what you make is going out in taxes. And here's another sobering statistic, by the way. Somewhere between 18 and 30% of what the average person makes goes out in debt service. Debt service being education loans, mortgage loans, consumer loans, auto loans, everything. Well, you don't need to be a CPA to figure this out. If you're paying roughly 20% in debt and 30% in taxes, that means 50% of what you make is already committed. So you only have 50% left to pay off all your living expenses, your education for your kids, your retirements, your insurance, your repairs, your medical, everything. So if you wonder why you can't get ahead, hello, that's the reason. And that's why it is so essential to get your taxes down to the legal minimum, because we all have those expenses. But by getting your taxes down with proper planning, we can then use that to help prepay our debts, to help fund our retirements. I mean, I'm a CPA. I'm not that smart. I'm really not. I'm okay. And I put away $2,000 when I was a kid. I had a paper route, and I put away $2,000 at that time into an IRA. I then maximized my simple IRA, and I put away money every single year. And now I am debt-free, and I'm a multimillionaire. Was I that smart? No. But I simply followed my advice of trying to get my taxes down to the legal minimum, saving money every single year, putting away the maximum amount into an IRA or into a pension plan. And when I had a little extra money, I used that to prepay my debt. That's all it took.
You know what? It is break time again. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Sandy Bodkin and Jim Lang on the Lang Money Hour. We will be right back.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Sandy, one of the things that I also noted that you say is that there are three major factors that every millionaire has in common. And I think that some of our listeners certainly would be interested in what these three things are.
Actually, it's interesting. I'm going to, I've actually changed that to six, and I will be putting out the upcoming book.
Okay.
You know, one of the good things about being a multimillionaire, let me put it this way, one thing about being a tax lawyer is you get to associate with rich people. I mean, let's face it, the average homeless doesn't come to a tax lawyer. And there are a couple things that I've noticed that every major tax lawyer that I've known said the same thing. And I'll share a couple of the major criteria of it that they have. First of all, most multimillionaires have an incredible belief system. They really believe they want to be rich. Now, it sounds funny, but I was talking to a guy who wrote Chicken Soup of the Soul. His name is Mark Victor Hansen.
And he's a character, isn't he?
He's a character. I like Mark very much. He's one of my favorite people. But Mark was saying that most people feel that they don't deserve to be rich. And when he first said that, I thought, frankly, the guy was full of it, until I was watching television, somebody winning a Powerball lottery, and she said, "I can't believe I won this. I didn't think I deserved it. I heard it myself. If I didn't hear it, I wouldn't have believed it." So one of the things that I recommend everyone to do, and I give them a little exercise, and if those of you listening to the radio, I would strongly urge you to do this, is that is every day, I want you to point to yourself. And if you're not doing it, I would do it now, and say, "I deserve to be rich." And then point to yourself and say, "I want to be rich." That exercise is very important, because it'll really motivate you to get over the hard days and things like that and get that belief system that you need. The second thing that most millionaires have is, which is also very, very interesting, is the fact that they almost every, first of all, this came out of the book, The Millionaire Next Door. Some of you may have heard about the book where they interviewed multimillionaires. And they found that people who are rich, and you think, well, maybe they did some sophisticated investing. Nope. Maybe they just made lots of money. Nope. 85% of all multimillionaires in the United States, 85%, were average folks. They were teachers, people you'd never think. But they did one thing that the average person didn't do. And here's the one thing they did. They were savers. They saved a minimum of 10% of what they made. They put that away for retirement, and they never touched that money. They didn't touch it for their kids' education. They didn't touch it for the dress that they wanted or the vacation. They never touched that money, and they learned to live on the other 90%. That's really critical. And the final thing is that almost every single multimillionaire said, if you want to be a multimillionaire, you got to get your taxes down to the legal minimum. I was the warm-up act for Donald Trump. I met him. I met his bodyguard pilot. I met his secretary. I met everybody. And he used to always say, you want to be a multimillionaire, you got to get your taxes down to the legal minimum. Sam Walton said the same thing before he died. Bill Gates set up a foundation. Why? Save taxes. And the reason for that, and this is so important, is it is very easy and simple to do. It really is. The number one comment that I get around the country is, where were you 5 or 10 or 20 years ago? The number two reason is that it's effective. You know, it's very interesting. I ask this at my seminars. And you probably know the answer to this, Jim. I said, if I were to give you a $17,000 raise, you actually get an increase in income of $17,000 a year, every year, for the next 10 years. Or I will cut your tax bill by $10,000 every year for the next 10 years. Which would you take? Most people figure the $17,000, that was the wrong answer. Because by the time you pay the taxes on the $17,000, you end up with less than $10,000. Having $10,000 in taxes saved is like earning almost $20,000. It's almost that much of a difference. And the third reason tax planning is so important is that it's the ultimate residual in the world. And when I say that to people, they think, oh, what is he talking about? You know, residual income is where you work once and you get paid year after year after year. But with a good example of that would be writing books. Another good example would be oil wells. But the problem is, for every one book that's published, people write 5,000 manuscripts, and maybe one in 100 really make money. For every oil well that's drilled, sure, some oil wells make huge amounts of money, and many oil wells have hit water. But with taxes, everybody pays them. You probably paid them last year. You're probably going to pay them this year. And with a $14 trillion deficit going up, you're probably going to pay even more next year. So if you get a good idea on how to save taxes, it's good this year, next year, the year after that. It is the best guaranteed residual in the world. And anyone that doesn't do tax planning is really, I mean, I don't want to call them an idiot, but they're really missing the boat.
Well, I would agree with that. And interestingly that you said that the people who tend to do very well over time are the long-term savers. For whatever it's worth, unlike you, Sandy, who obviously specializes in small business, and that's probably the best market for your book, although frankly I think a lot of those things apply to everybody, most of my clients actually are not businesses, but they are individuals, engineers, college professors, teachers, mid-level managers. People, and the people who have significant amounts of money, they never necessarily even made a huge amount of money. But what they did is they regularly, on a consistent basis, put the maximum into their retirement plan, often working for companies that either matched at least a portion of it, and they did it, like you said, year after year after year.
And they never took that money out. By the way, I want to emphasize a couple things here, folks, that you know, but I want to make sure your listeners know. When you put that money into a stock market, most people who do this, are, especially you know, mutual funds have averaged over 9% rate of return long term, and yet the average investor has probably done less than 5%. You might wonder why would the average investor do 5% when the mutual funds do 9? Are they lying? No. Here's what happens. There's a fear greed cycle. People put money in a mutual fund every year, and they put money every year. And then what happens is the market starts going down because market goes up, market goes down. They go, well, I'm a little nervous, but I'll wait it out. Market drops even more. Now they're getting nervous. Now their friends are telling them about killer crocodiles and all the horrible things going on in the economy. You have to just read the paper. The market still drops. The pain becomes enormous. They sell. But like everything else, everything is a cycle. The market then starts going up, and they go, well, I'm not sure. I'm going to wait. Market goes up a little further, maybe a little further, then they buy. So what happens is most people who do not use a planner, who do not have their money managed for them, who become emotional, buy high and sell low. That is what happens. So what people need to do, and you know I'm right, Jim, what people need to do is they need to put their money away every year, and if they don't need it in the next 3 years, don't worry about it. Now, I would start lightening up on the market if you need the money. Like the minute, if let's say your kids are going to college in 2 or 3 years, at that point, I might start putting it into more fixed-type things. But you don't touch the money. You just leave it for retirement. Your retirement is just for that, retirement.
Well, I would agree with that. And by the way, I actually have a little bit of a rant on, and it's partly inspired by Jonathan Clemens, who agrees with me, who says, uh-huh. take care of your retirement first, then your kids' college education second.
Absolutely.
Because you can't make up for your retirement.
It blows me away, completely blows me away, how people will spend 100, 150, 200,000 in debt or compromise their retirement forever in order to send that kid to that wonderful school instead of the state university with a full scholarship or a state university with a partial scholarship. I don't get it.
I have a very good friend, one of my best friends in the world, was in that situation, and his daughter had a full boat to a very good state school and not a full boat to a very expensive school. And I was thinking, boy, if she wants to go, and she wants to go to the expensive school, it should be on her dime. And by the way, when I was growing up, I really wanted to go to Syracuse, which was pretty expensive at the time. And my parents said, well, we're going to pay for state school tuition. If you want to go to Syracuse, go ahead and just pick up the difference. When I realized how much debt I was going to be in, I thought, well, maybe I'll just be happy with the state school.
And you did the right thing. I don't know anybody to this day, and I've met a lot of people in my life, I can't think of one who is happy having a $200,000 or $150,000 of debt for a college.
Well, and what I would say is, if you're in a fortunate position, and it sounds like you are, and let's say that your daughter was able to get into a good school and you could afford it, great, why not? But for people who are not in that situation, I think it's really hard. Now, one of the things that you do in your book is you say, okay, well, whatever you're going to be paying, let's try to take advantage of some of the tax aspects of college tuition and planning for college tuition. So maybe we could talk about that for a little bit, because I know we have listeners who have children in college. And then the other thing is, I probably have more clients who have grandchildren who are approaching or are in college than parents. So if we could look at it from both.
Let's talk about it. Let's talk about the best way to save for college. First of all, I want to emphasize something. Most financial planners will tell you, and I think you're an exception to the rule, by the way, Jim, but most financial planners will tell you, we'll save up for college, but they leave out the other half of the equation. And the other half of the equation is, if you can, hire your kids in your business. Pay them a wage. Wages that you pay an assistant in business, if it's reasonable, is deductible. And then if they use that money to pay for their own college or their own education, aren't you, in essence, getting a deduction for those things? It's the same money. But in one case, it went from non-deductible to deductible wages. You can hire them things like LIC envelopes, address envelopes. If you live in Washington, D.C. or Houston, Texas, shred documents. All kinds of stuff. maybe the listeners will get that one.
I haven't heard that one.
No extra charge on that one, Jim. But the point is, do those things. Now, the question is, let's say you hire your kids, which is what I did. Then what do you do with the money? Well, the answer is you have a couple good options. One of the options is every state university, every state that I know of, has what they call a prepaid tuition plan, which is what I used actually for most of my kids. And the prepaid tuition plan is you put a fixed amount of money in, and it covers them for 4 years of tuition and required fees, regardless of the tuition, regardless of what it is, when they go to school. And that's really, really good. Your rate of return on that, with the way college has been appreciating in tuition, has been enormous. And that's called a prepaid tuition plan. It's a qualified tuition plan. It's highly recommended. And people ask, well, what happens if my kid doesn't go to a state university? Well, that's what happened with my daughter. My daughter actually got into a state university in Cincinnati because she wanted to go for digital design. But she also got into Carnegie Mellon on a wait list. And they called her up, and she said, well, what kind of a scholarship are you going to give me? And they looked at her like, what do you mean scholarship? You're on wait list. And she said, no problem. I'll go to the one that's giving me money. Thank you. I was so proud of her, I can't tell you. But
by the way, the people in Pittsburgh are wincing, because this is a Pittsburgh show. I'll just happen to remind you that this is a Pittsburgh show.
We are home to Carnegie Mellon.
My wife is a graduate of Carnegie Mellon. She has a math degree, and then she actually has a master's in electrical engineering from Carnegie Mellon. But
I understand. I think Carnegie Mellon's a great place.
Okay,
but,
very
you
good.
Know, if it's a toss up between $55,000 a year and $8,000 a year,
yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Anyway, that's beside the point. Where was I going? Now it's like, my train of thought.
All right, you're talking about children financing and the prepaid plan.
If they, it's because I had a prepaid tuition with Maryland, but what Maryland did, and this is true of a lot of other plans, is they will pay out what the tuition would have been at the University of Maryland. So every year, her college, which is University of Cincinnati School of Design, Art, Architecture, and Planning, gets a check on what the tuition would have been, which covers probably 80% of the tuition.
Right. And by the way, I should point out to listeners, a prepaid tuition plan is a variation of a 529 plan.
That's the next one. That's the next one I'm talking about. Now, the second one is a Section 529 plan, which is also a qualified tuition plan. Now, Section 529 plan is where it's like a mutual fund in a sense. You put money in, it's set up by a financial, probably by you or by other financial institutions.
Well, I'm kind of a cheapskate, so I tend to use the state ones. Pennsylvania actually has the Vanguard set.
Pennsylvania has a 529? Okay.
Yeah, well, I think all the states do, but Pennsylvania used to have, and I better watch out, I think they used to have, they had a, well, they had a set of funds that I wasn't such a big fan of, and then recently they switched to, or maybe 5 years ago, they switched to Vanguard as the custodian of their plans, and I was much happier with the investment choices.
Got it. Okay. Well, the 529 plan is different in that it will also cover, well, it doesn't cover guaranteed tuition. That's the one thing it doesn't do like the prepaid tuition plans do. But the 529 plan is like a mutual fund, which can be used to pay tuition anywhere, plus required fees, plus I think it can also cover room and board, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
I could be wrong on that. I think it does. And
computers and supplies and et cetera.
Correct. And it's tax-free for undergraduate education.
Right. So what you have to do is you have to compare the, let's say, the rate of return that is above a market rate of return in terms of tuition inflation with the prepaid plan versus the, let's say, additional flexibility of being able to go anywhere.
And you could do both.
Actually, that's probably even the best
solution.
And
you can switch any relative. If you have a kid that doesn't want to go, or you want to use it for your grandkid, or you want to use it for your niece and nephew, you can switch relatives.
Right, and you can switch between first cousins, for example.
That's right.
So if you're
you can do both. Now, the third type of thing I want to emphasize, so we talked the prepaid tuition. Oh, yes, prepaid tuition, the Section 529 plan, and there's something new that came in within the last couple of years. It's called a prepaid tuition for private schools. There is a private prepaid tuition plan, and for the life of me, I can't think of the name of the plan, that if you do a search on Google, you'll be able to find it, where there are 300 major private institutions that subscribe to it. And you put a certain amount of money away, and it will guarantee 4 years of tuition at any of those private schools, including required fees.
Right, but then again, now you have to guess, gee, is my kid going to go to a private school or a state school?
Correct, that's the problem with it. That's the downside. Correct.
Right, but maybe if you know... Maybe if you know, I know, for example, I would probably prefer my daughter, I think, would do better at a smaller school, and it might very well likely be a private school, so that might actually be a reasonable choice for me. Her mother, by the way, wants her to go to CMU, of course.
Of course.
she's actually a math kid. She takes after her mom. She's a whiz in math. But that might be a reasonable choice if somebody is more realistically... their kids or grandkids are more realistically going to a state school, then a prepaid state tuition plan might be good. And if you're just not willing to make that commitment and you're willing to accept, in effect, a lower rate where you're not actually buying credits, you're just investing the money and having it, in effect, tax like a Roth IRA, where you get you don't get a tax deduction going in, but the money grows income tax-free.
Correct.
Then a traditional 529 plan is probably a good answer. Or your idea, which I like, is some combination.
Some combination, which I think is the ideal, most flexibility. But I want to emphasize one more thing before everybody goes. I'm going to give them one shot. You know, every now and then I like to give one really wow tip, and I want to give a really wow tip to everybody who's listening in, so they're going to love this show. And here's your wow tip. Remember I talked about hiring kids and that you can deduct the wages? Well, how would you like to get in-state tuition for an out-of-state student?
We like that.
Mm-hmm. Let me mention this. Let me tell you the difference. My daughter went to University of Cincinnati. The tuition there was, at that time, for an out-of-state kid, about $24,000 a year. In-state was $8,000. Yep. Okay?
Yep.
Most state universities have an option to be able to get in-state tuition. They have a couple options. Some of the things where parents can move to the state, you can join the military. Some of these things are not viable. But they have those options. But there's one other thing that's kind of hidden in most states. It's not everywhere, but it is in Ohio and it is in some other states. And that is, if you can show your kid is truly independent of the parents, then they can get in-state tuition. Independent means they pay their own tuition, they pay their own room and board, they pay out of funds in their name, or they're working and they're paying their these expenses out of their name. So here's the point. We've been hiring my daughter for years, okay, particularly when she designed the website. We had a lot of money in her name. Her tuition was completely paid in year one by her. Her room and board were paid by her. She established residency. She filed Ohio tax returns. We stopped claiming her as a dependent. That's very important, by the way. She also had a voter's registration. When year two came around, we filed for residency status based on the fact that she was independent.
You have about 30 seconds.
Done.
Okay.
All right.
Very, very good. Anyway, Sandy, it has been a pleasure. You've given our listeners a lot to think about. The book is
Lower Your Taxes Big Time.
By Sandy Botkin. Thank you so much. This is Jim Lang. We're at the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
And make your life less taxing.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. The audio that you just heard will be posted online at retiresecure.com. You can also find a list of upcoming workshops at retiresecure.com. To seek Jim's advice personally or to speak to a member of his dedicated staff at the Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, call 412-521-2732. Join us again in 2 weeks when we talk more smart money.